We live in fear. Fear of failure, commitment, each other, and beyond. It's one of the few things that unites us all. Salem, Massachusetts knows this more than most, which is why Salem Horror Fest will return this October to explore societal themes of fear and anxiety in Halloween, capital of the world. Prepare yourself for 2 weeks of terror with screenings, panels, podcasts, special guests, parties, premieres, and more in the haunted and historic Witch City. Raise hell with Linnea Quigley and George C. Romero. Conjure demons with the Faculty of Horror and repent before the latest film from Darren Lynn Bousman. Behold Wolfman's Nards with the Monster Squad's Andre Gower and relive your kinder trauma for the New England premiere of the Scary Stories documentary. Yours truly, Ryan Turek, will present the opening night keynote speech on October 4th, followed by the 30th anniversary celebration of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark with Cassandra Peterson. Tickets and weekend passes are available now. To overcome fear, we must first understand it. SalemHorror.com.
From Severn Films, uncut on Blu-ray for the first time ever, The Horror of Party Beach. When nuclear waste dumped into the ocean mutates a shipwreck full of corpses, it will unleash an onslaught of bikini teens, buckets of gore, dubious science, and arguably the greatest worst monsters in horror movie history. I can confirm that. I saw it late night once, and it is a shocker. I think we called him the penis face monster or something. Anyway, that's off script. Severn Films is proud to present this cult favorite from Connecticut's own Ed Wood, now featuring a new 2K scan and loaded with all new special features like nothing that's ever stalked this earth. The Horror of Party Beach, the world's first horror monster musical. Visit Severn-Films.com for their full line of horror and cult classic special edition Blu-rays, including The Changeling, Fulci Zombie 3, Zombie 4, Shocking Dark, Eaten Alive, and Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals. Coming in September, I'm very excited about this, Joe D'Amato's Anthropophagus and Absurd. That is the correct way to say Anthropophagus.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they have all new Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 arrivals. Also, the officially licensed Alien and Aliens collections featuring t-shirts and pins. The awesome new Warriors line is now available. The brand new They Live line featuring multiple shirts and awesome enamel pins. And they now have a full line of both House and House 2 merch available for both men and women, if you can believe that House 2 has merchandise now. So head to www.fright-rags.com now. You can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network has recently launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes the players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awaits. Currently available on the Blumhouse Podcast Network, and you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. And for more information, please find Fear Initiative on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
I just want to mention, too, that Slashback Video is returning to the Mystic Museum on September 8th. This is called Revenge of Slashback Video, and it is a sequel to that crazy installation that we did last year that thrusts you into the mom and pop video store experience. We'll have new tapes, we're gonna have laser discs, we're gonna have video games, we got new posters, we got new, all sorts of really cool new stuff. The reception again is September 8th, and the entire installation will be up until I think December. We're gonna feel it out. It actually lasted a lot longer than we expected last year just because of the response. But head to facebook.com/slashback video or Instagram for more details. So
yeah. Last time there was a line around the block, so if we hadn't had our names on the list, I don't know if I could have ever made it into that.
Don't scare people.
We got to elbow ourselves in.
We'll get there early.
Yeah, get there early for sure.
All Okay, and welcome to episode 111 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Elric Kane.
Yeah, man.
What's up, buddy?
I'm excited for you because you're about to get to see France, and that's pretty cool.
Well, London first. By the time you hear this, as you're listening now, I will be in London.
There's a place in France where the... Yeah.
What about France?
We got lots of rhymes about France.
Anyway, I'll be, while you're listening to this, I'm at Fright Fest right now.
Cool.
Hopefully, so with some shockers.
Then. Yeah, go see them.
And then Paris, that's vacation. But I'm also here with Ryan Turek.
Hello. I'm not at Fright Fest.
No. And Rebecca McKendry.
I'm not at Fright Fest either.
The whole gang is here. I hope this caffeine kicks in so I don't sound like I'm asleep for the rest of this episode.
I don't know, Rob.
Or maybe it won't.
Maybe he'll fall asleep in an hour.
If Rob falls asleep, we're writing shit on his forehead. That's all there is.
Fair enough. So, God, what's going on? It feels like a lot.
I think it's a lot. No, I think our problem is, let's just be honest for a second. It is hard to come down from Udo. Udo might have been one of the greatest guests we've ever had. The funniest story. And the reception to that episode has been pretty magnificent.
It has been good.
Like, people really love Udo. Like, they're coming off going, I want audiobooks.
We should have taken this week off and let the Udo episode marinate
just
a little bit.
Just a little wiped.
Yeah. No, and I mean, plus, like,
I want to spoon him for a while. We need that post.
Udo wants
I have a feeling Udo would be okay with that. You could have propositioned him. And he would be like, yes, on, yes, spooning,
his,
yes.
On his, what was his horse again?
His horse named Max Van Sydow.
Just me and Udo on Max Van Sydow.
Someone pitched that show. It was Udo Kier and Werner Herzog on a farm with his horse, Max Van Sydow. He's like, I would watch the shit out of them.
Oh, just
That's kind of brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want them both as farmers, just kind of on the farm with the horse, Max Van Sydow.
That would be pretty amazing.
But it's also nice when you get the public persona of someone, and we've seen him at conventions, so you don't really know. Because on stage, he's pretty wild when he does Q&As. And so I just didn't know what Udo we were going to get. And we've always kind of
made
fun of it.
We got the best possible Udo
utterly charming man.
He was a little more... when I've worked with him at conventions, he's always really unbridled, and it always makes me question, like, is he drunk or is that just him? He was a little more controlled here, he was really
Udo energy. Yeah. Becca,
I love it. Udo energy.
Ciara listened to the episode and she was just like, I love that man. And I looked him up on Google. I had to Google him and look at his older
house.
Days.
Oh,
his older, his younger days, I should say.
Yeah. He was beautiful.
And she was like, he was hot.
He was so beautiful.
A handsome looking
very
dude.
Striking.
Yeah.
And you should look him up, though. Look up his house stuff, because it is pretty amazing. He really lives in this kind of incredibly designer house in Palm Springs, and somebody did an article on it, and he has all these like fashion chairs and stuff, and you're like, wow, this is a totally different portrait of this man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he was hanging out with Warhol, and I'm sure he kept like a trash can, a couple of the soup cans, and did okay with it.
So,
I know, I had a lot of fun. That was probably the most fun I've had doing the show this year, in terms of, like, besides our live shows, where it's just like, wow, that was
hell of a I'm on the hunt in London for Blood of Dracula, because there is a Blu-ray of it there.
Nice.
Not here. Not in 3D, unfortunately, but it's all right.
Well, that one's not 3D. Only Frankenstein.
Oh, the Frankenstein was 3D.
Yeah, okay. That's the 3D one. And
I think both of them
good,
are in the UK on Blu-ray, so I'm going to try to track those down while I'm there.
So, UK listeners, while Rob is over there and you meet him at Fright Fest, give him hell for not watching Inside Number 9.
Oh.
Yeah. Because they know it's damn good. British Attack on Inside Number 9.
All right. Come at me.
I may make you buy me the new season while you're over there, because it has not come here yet, and I'm dying because everyone keeps telling me about it and I can't get to it. So,
all right. If it's out on DVD or Blu-ray,
I'll text you.
I'll pick it up. All right. What should we jump in with first?
Good question.
I watched
Becca
Ricky
looks so excited,
The Story of Ricky. Yeah, I'm fucking excited. I watched Ricky O, The Story of Ricky. And this was kind of a blind purchase, like a blind watch. Like, I somehow have completely missed this movie. And as soon as I posted about it, everybody was like, how have you never heard of this? How have you never seen it? This is the greatest bonkers movie ever in the entire world of bonkers movies. And then Elric was like, this was like the highlight of your prison episode.
Because actually, like you,
cinema.
Believe it or not, I've had friends telling me about this film my whole life, but it wasn't until this year that I watched it for a prison episode, and it was like my new watch, and I was like, holy shit. Like, he punches through people.
So this one was recommended by one of my brand new students yesterday. And I was talking, when I was doing my intro to the class, I was talking about how much, my background in exploitation. One of my students was like, do you like kung fu films? And I was like, I've seen some of the Bruce Lee knockoff movies, but I don't know kung fu films that well. And he was like, you need to watch Story of Ricky O. So immediately I went home and found it on Amazon. Not Prime. I had to sign up for Con TV
to watch it. But you get
TV? What does that mean? TV.
So Con TV. Con. I'll start with Con TV.
Con Film Festival.
Con, oh. Like convention con.
You mean cans.
Con. Yeah. Like con. Oh, C-O-N. Like con convention. Like Comic-Con.
Oh.
So the majority of
Ryan
what...
Ryan went highbrow with Ricky O.
I
like, well, I mean, you never know when you're going to find some Ricky O.
Ricky O goes to Cannes every year. No, Con TV. So the majority of the stuff on that channel, I will say, is like interview with geeky celebrities at conventions. So it is not something that I will
You're
probably...
You're lucky to have signed up for that.
You get a free trial. So I at least signed up for the free trial and was able to float around. But the cool thing that I'd never had this happen before, when I typed in Story of Ricky O on Amazon, it popped up on my computer and it says available on, and then it gave me like three different platforms that I could try out. And it was like Toki channel, Con TV channel, and it was some other one. And I was like, well, let's try Con TV.
This is the new Fandorm, just letting you know.
The new Fandorm. Well, no, I honestly, I will not stay subscribed to Con TV because it was all interviews for the most part. But they did have a couple movies on there. Anyway, Ricky O, what the fuck?
Talk about it.
Oh my God. So this is from 1991. It is, don't you start with me, Turek. Don't you fucking start with me.
I was like, let's just get into it.
I know. So 1991, wow. Hong Kong martial art, or Hong Kong martial arts film.
Prison film.
Prison.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, like I'm still a little rocky on the plot.
Yeah, there's a flashback in there where you see him in.
There's a lot of flashbacks. Calvin, yeah. There's a lot of flashbacks. So Ricky had been training his whole life to be kind of this strong master. Something happened to his girlfriend. He somehow got shot a bunch of times, ended up in prison, and is the strongest man alive and does not feel pain. There's actually a scene where he gets cut and he ties the veins off. Like literally yeah. pulls the veins out of his arm, ties them off
awesome.
With his teeth, mm-hmm. and then continues fighting.
Explodes a head, punches through a stomach. I mean, there's yeah. moments where the effects, practical effects are so good that my mind's just like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
Like, it's truly, like if you really want to find the ultimate holy fucking shit. It's definitely top five all-time holy fucking shit movies. Like,
yeah.
it's one of the preeminent. You know,
so he gets into prison, and he ends up fighting for the prisoners, which is actually really interesting because the prison becomes kind of the corporate. It kind of rang true because they were doing this, like, post-apocalyptic, like, in the future, all prisons become privatized. And I was like, hey, we're already there. But the prison is run by this really corrupt group, and so that's what Ricky's actually fighting against. And he befriends the prisoners and is trying to seek justice for them. And then there's this weird group of like supervillains that live underground in the prison called the Gang of Four. One of them looks like the lead singer of the Human League, which was a little confusing. But they tend to be like the superheroes of the movie. And then Ricky has to defeat each of them individually.
It also has moments that feel like some of the characters come out of Big Trouble Little China.
The Gang of Four.
I honestly have not seen this movie.
How have you not?
No, I haven't seen it since college.
Oh, okay, but you have seen it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the Amazon one that I watched, it was not the greatest quality. I don't know if a good quality edition of it exists.
I have seen it.
This was a pan scan, but it was still well worth it. So story, Ricky O, the story of Ricky, it's kind of just a must.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Becca?
Again?
What the fuck?
I'm saying, I'm giving her shit.
That's unusual.
Hey, UK Blu-ray. UK Blu-ray.
Okay.
I'm picking it up right now while this episode airs.
All right.
Take that.
Got the UK Blu-ray of Story of Ricky.
No, I'm saying because when this airs, I will be there and I will be buying it while this episode airs.
Oh my God, I want to see
some local London store.
I want to see the theatrical now. So yeah. What the fuck,
Trey? No, I was trying to think of what's that? Multiverse. I was like, hey, Becky, it's a multiverse?
No.
Since we're going down
it's
this weird
that.
Path
yeah,
of
yeah.
Rob speaking from the future about
Rob
what he's buying
now.
I'm in the future in another country.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So you're into multiverses too, Turek.
Totally
into multiverses.
Can we talk about multiverses in which John Carpenter made a film called Village of the Damned?
We could.
So I recently... saw it on Stars. It was on Stars. It was in my little queue with vampires, which I haven't seen in forever. We'll get to that.
I did both of them this year, too. So
I like Village of the Damned.
Well, let's get to just like kind of analyzing what works. And what works is him being beholden to the story and maintaining that really unsettling vibe of a town being knocked out and a number of women being... getting pregnant from an alien force, which is, I think, now even creepier and spookier. Because mm-hmm. Sierra next to me was like, wait a second, what? They got violated while they were knocked out? And I was like, yes. And then once the kids are born, you know, it still works. I think like
it's a big time jump too.
That's big. That's a big time jump. But to me, what does not work, and it's such a significant part of the film, is the cast. Mm. I love Christopher Reeve. Fantastic human being.
You don't like Skywalker?
I think he is Skywalker. I think he is miscast in the film. Linda Kozlowski? I'm blanking on her name. I thought she was miscast.
Kirstie Alley is definitely miscast.
Kirstie Alley is actually a lot more amusing in the film than I remember seeing
her. I like all of them individually, but I just don't know if they come together as
they
a
don't
group.
Come together. Yeah. And I had a good laugh because Mark Hamill's first line in the film is, "We need finger paints." And I was like, and there's the introduction to Luke Skywalker.
He's always at 11 post Star Wars. That guy was always, seriously. You know.
I thought the kids are really good. I think the photography is beautiful. The locale is beautiful. But it just like at the very end, it just doesn't resonate. Like, I mean, like I really defended the film in college. Mm. Film came out at the height of like me being super stoked about John Carpenter being back. I was riding the high of In the Mouth of Madness. But you know, I'm still so mixed on it, you know?
I don't think I saw it when it came out. I rediscovered this when Scream Factory did their Blu-ray last year. Yeah. And the reason I defend it, even though I recognize what you say, the whole movie doesn't work, that opening like 15 minutes really or good. 20 minutes is like some of the best Carpenter.
And what he does efficiently is he gets to setting up the town, setting up the blackout, moving on. Whereas the original, because I watched the original earlier this year, and it's a little bit sluggish. Mm. You know, they really dwell on the mystery of what's going on. And what John and the team add to it is there's like a moment where like a guy goes walking past the barrier, and as soon as he walks in, he like immediately keels over and like drag him back with rope, you know?
Yeah, I love
and
that.
And my memory could be wrong. They might have done it in the original, but I just found it a lot more intense than the original film. So you're right. And that first 20 minutes really work well in terms of setting it up. It's just the living with the children, I wish, had a little bit more creepier vibe.
Also, you have to rely on children actors who are, you know, doing their best, but it's always limited. I think it's a deeper versus broader problem. Like, if I was going to remake this story, you've got the one woman who really loves her son, and he's the one who's kind of on, you know, becoming almost
a mix.
I think to tell a story, when you're trying to do something uniformly and show every character and their relationship with their kid, you've gone so broad that you have no real emotional anchor. And I think a story like this, if you focused on, it's really the main character is this woman who still loves her son and is torn about it, and then show little bits of everyone else, but it's never really rooted anyone.
They try to anchor it with Christopher Reeve and Linda Kozlowski. I mean, like her husband is Michael Perret in the film. He gets offed right away.
That's right.
And they try to anchor it in that respect, but you're absolutely right. It needed a central point, and you're right. Kirstie Alley is a little. I like her performance. She's really amusing in it, but she's a little out of touch in the film. You know?
It would be like, because Halloween's so good at introducing you to everyone, but then really going, and now your focus is on her. I feel like that's the thing. You can set up a world, but then you got to find a focus.
Yeah, and I feel like there's, and I could be absolutely wrong in this, but I feel like there was like a desire from the studio to push for really extravagant deaths. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got Buck Flower who accidentally nicks one of the kids with his broom handle, and then they proceed to put the whammy on him, and he takes the broom, props up the ladder, walks up the ladder onto the roof of the school, puts the broomstick in front of his chest, and then jumps off onto a truck.
Yeah.
So he gets speared. I'm like, that was really complex, kids. That was complex.
They could have just blown up his head.
Could have stabbed himself in the eye.
The good thing about Carpenter, and that the main thing I learned from doing that at the episode of Pure Cinema this year on him, was that all the lighter stuff, even the ones I don't love, are so well crafted. Like his directing ability, even in The Ward, which I'm really not a fan of, the actual directing of it, it's at a really high level. So it's like his craft never took in it. It's more just the stories and maybe his interest in the stories.
I know his heart, from what I understand, I think he was up for another remake, but it was one of those jobs. I think they're pretty candid about this on the Blu-ray. Yeah. I think it was one of those jobs that he really wanted to remake something else, but in order to do it, the studio's like, well, you have to do Village of the Damned first.
Got it.
So his heart wasn't 100% into. I'm sure he thought
effects were cut.
Yeah, I'm sure he thought the movie was like, oh yeah, I like the original. That's cool. That'll be fun. And then he didn't. You know, I don't think it's a secret he didn't get along with Reeves at all, and he didn't get along with Chevy Chase either. So it's like here's two movies back to back where your lead is very difficult.
Yeah.
But I still, again, I think I give it a pass just for how. Like if you just showed that opening 20 minutes out of context, you could sell it as some of the best stuff Carpenter's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So I give it a lot of leeway for that.
Yeah.
Vampires, however, I don't know.
Well, I'm gonna revisit Vampires this week because that's another one I have not seen in forever. And
it's
I'm
a
ready.
Perfect movie for the Me Too movement. It's just the tone of that movie is so like
it's incredibly misogynistic. Yes.
Yeah, I especially have not Baldwin, watched it since it came out, and I have not had any urge to revisit it whatsoever.
It definitely has some cool.
Woods. Oh, yeah, it does it? Well, that's the other thing. It's got James Woods now.
Oh, God, it's got James Woods now.
Hey, Rob, give you wood? Does it give you wood? Padre? Hey, Padre. Yeah, that's all I remembered before I rewatched it. I saw a bunch of stuff, but I saw something that I never even heard of that Dick bought called House of the Dead, a.k.a. Alien Zone, a horror anthology from 1978.
This is not House of the Dead, the video game.
No, this
movie.
Is a horror anthology. So I looked up House of the Dead and found nothing. That's what the title on it. And then I looked up Alien Zone and found it. No aliens to be found in this movie, so the title's totally bizarre. This is a Oklahoma-set horror anthology and shot at a pretty high level. This doesn't feel
1978?
Like... 1978? Yeah, 78. Wow. Doesn't feel like a cheap movie at all. That is the cover. Mm. So this was just released, I guess, by Vinegar Syndrome. And you know, we're always batting 1,000 with Vinegar, who I do love. Keep up the good work, guys. I'm not trying to be mean. This is a strange fucking movie. Well, interestingly enough, this was the biggest surprise for that time. This is directed by Sharon Miller. So it was a female director at that point in 78 doing a horror anthology, and I've never even heard of it. I was like, oh, that's interesting. It's really competently made. She went on to do a lot of TV. I don't think any other movies. But the setup's kind of cool. It's just some guy who's having it opens with him. He's having an affair with a woman. He's flown into town. And then he gets lost on his way back. He takes a taxi, and it feels a little Messiah of Evil-ish in terms of like he's just on these streets. And it's very vacant, and he can't find his hotel. And then he gets pulled into this guy says, you know, come in out of the rain, you know, I'll look, you know, hang out with you for a little while, and turns to be a morgue, like this, like, kind of home-based morgue. Mm-hmm. And then each time he opens a coffin to show him his different clients, each one is a story. The first one is the most horror-ish. It's actually really cool. Remind me a bit of Jace and Adam's story in Tales from Halloween. It's about kids kind of taking revenge. And it's really got a great little ending. And it's really creepy. Feels Halloween-ish. then after that, they kind of become increasingly less horror feeling. One feels quite a lot like a Tales from the Crypt thing, but a little talky. I can't say this is a great film by any means, but it was competently made. It was kind of fun. And it was cool to discover something that we had never even heard. I like literally had never even heard of this thing. But yeah, it's always a little disappointing with anthologies. It's always good if there's one good story, but when there's also three, they're just like, that's kind of how it felt. But,
So this is the House of the Dead, aka Alien Zone.
So I wasn't sure if this made your anthology list last year.
It did not.
Year,
I'd never heard of it until just now.
And I've never heard of Sharon Miller, and I'm now researching her and totally impressed.
It's just interesting when it's somebody you haven't heard of, especially at that time. Like 78 is pretty early. So
she was the first to win the DGA award, first female to win DGA for non-dramatic, non-documentary film.
Oh, that's cool.
So was for The Woman Who Willed a Miracle, which was an after-school special.
But to jump on it, because it's only micro, I also saw a short I love that it relates to you because you're a big fan of his work, Steve Daniels.
I love Steve.
Yeah, I'd seen that they had a new short at festivals, and so I wrote to him saying, hey, I'd love to see this. And I've always wanted to see A.J. Bowen as a trucker.
I've seen this. I just watched it.
Dude,
it's wonderful.
The tone of this movie is such a high wire act. I absolutely love it. It's really zany and also quite like disturbing at times, but it's a diabetic. Well, I'm just reading the synopsis. A diabetic trucker played by AJ is traveling the highways of the South. He's going from like 7-Eleven to 7-Eleven and pee break to pee break. And somebody out there is murdering truck stop prostitutes, and he's kind of tracking it, but mostly through the radio. So it's got horror vibes. It's like 20 minutes. I just thought it was so much fun.
What was the name of it again?
It's called Blood Spook.
Blood Spook?
It's at the festival circuit now. So I wanted to give a plug because, you know, if people are programming, we have a lot of friends who program festivals. But the coolest thing, it has the son of Warren Oates in a cameo playing his dad's character from Tulane Blacktop. dressed the same as GTO.
Oh my gosh.
And I just went, oh my God. That's
Does he look
thing.
Like Warren
he
Oates?
Looks a little, enough that I knew because they warned me. They go, hey, just so you know, there's a cameo. And as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh my God, he's dressed like GTO. So that was super cool. But there's some cool, uneasy stuff. There's a really creepy old witch type kind of character in the background. It's just, I love shorts that are really unpredictable in tone. Like he's going between.
I got to tell you, Steve Daniels, I discovered him way, way, way back. Because
well, you introduced me to him to play some stuff at Jump.
Yeah, well, because he had a short that ended up on the Fangoria Blood Drive Volume 2.
Which one?
It was, what was it? The Gibbering Horror of Howard Normley, which was the black and white one. Mm-hmm. Stuart Gordon endorsed it at the time. And I just reached out to him, and he's like, he's totally like the Sam Raimi of, I forget where he is right now.
Like North Carolina or
North Carolina. Because then he sent me like a disc of all his shorts. Yeah. Even the ones he shot on VHS are like incredible. He did one called The Stash, which is on YouTube.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Which is basically about a mustache. It's hilarious.
So which one did you screen at Jump Cut?
Dirty Silverware. Yeah. That was one that I thought had like, it was Steve's voice, but like totally like Del Toro style about, it was like, you know, the guy with one hand and who was in love with the girl. But then it's about that the one piece of silverware that's always
missing
or off. And it turns out that they all get collected by a monster that becomes a giant thing of silverware. Mm. If you've never seen it, I gotta find it. It's probably online. I'll definitely share it.
And didn't he have a really good – he didn't make the ABCs of Death cut.
T is for Termite.
Yeah, T is for Termite is one of the ones that was online and it was really good. It was like better than most of the
– Yeah, I gotta reach out to him again because he's one of those filmmakers that I wish more people knew about. So.
But that's a super
cool
one. And
thanks for bringing
that up. I preferred that to anything in the anthology.
Oh, yeah, wow.
That's why I brought it up there because it was a short.
Wow. Well, I wanted to bring these up last week, but of course we couldn't keep Udo waiting. And I want to talk to Ryan about this because I know Ryan's a Darkman fan, and I love Darkman.
Yeah.
Big fan of when that came out. So I got Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die. Hold on. Don't jump ahead of me. And because Scream Factory put 2 and 3 out on Blu-ray, and I think there's a fairly inexpensive DVD set that has all three on there. Mm. I remember these came out because Darkman was 1990. 2 and 3 were direct-to-video movies that came out in 95 and 96. Mm-hmm. So a good 5-6 years later, they recast with Arnold Vosloo, the mummy, who looks nothing like Liam Neeson. I'm not sure why. I don't think the mummy's, what, 99 or so?
But he had done
Hard Target, baby.
He was in Hard Target.
He was? Hard Target. Oh, my gosh.
But I don't – all right.
But Hard Target was produced in, or EP'd by Raimi, wasn't it?
Maybe.
Maybe it was.
So maybe there's like a Raimi. Little. Maybe there's a Raimi connection there.
John
someone else could correct
Raimi
me.
Connected. That would be interesting.
So, I kind of want them to do more together. Yeah. Now I have to rewatch Hard Target. Yeah.
So these were both. They were shot back to back. They were both directed by a guy named Bradford May. And I remember when they came out, thinking obviously, like, oh, these are, you know, some fairly terrible Darkman direct to video sequels. However, here's what I love doing is when I haven't seen Darkman, the first one, since the Blu-ray came out a couple years ago. So I have it. Not so fresh in my mind, just my memory of, oh, yeah, it was pretty cool. And I think we did it at Jump Cut as well.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm just going to dive into part 3 because that's the one I have. Jeff Fahey's the bad guy. So it's like, all right. Yeah. And sure, it's a little adjustment period within the first like 5-10 minutes being like, this guy's not Liam Neeson. But it gets so quirky and weird that I actually like thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think it's kind of a fun and quirky like superhero movie. A perfect example of a set piece that I thought was hilarious is you know, he at one point disguises himself as Jeff Fahey because that's his deal. He's a chameleon. And he goes back home because he's walking into Jeff Fahey's house to steal something that's in his safe. And so when he walks in, surprise, it's a surprise birthday party for him. So he is now, Darkman is now stuck at a surprise birthday party. His daughter, who he's suddenly being nice to, you know, wants him to stay and, you know, tuck her in. And then, of course, he gets pressured to play the piano. They're like, come on, just do one song for us, just one.
Wow.
And so it's one of those things that is just fun. It's a fun gag seeing Darkman like, try to get out of this.
Yeah, it feels like a situational, like a sitcom. Mm-hmm. It's like if Darkman the series ever happened as a TV show. It's like, what if Darkman walked in on a surprise birthday party, guys.
And that's the thing. It felt like picking up a comic book 10 years into its run and being like, oh, all right, this is kind of cool had it been a TV series. And what's interesting, and also there's a stunt that I had to post on Instagram because they're running out of an explosion, and I guess they did it once. And so in the wide shot, these people are on fire. and then in the close-up, they're not, because it's supposed to be Darkman. Yeah. And then it goes again, and they are just on fire. And I'm like, I hope those people are right, because that stunt, that's the beauty of Blu-ray, is that stunt did not work at all, but it's still in the movie. And even more so. So I'm just curious who this guy Bradford May is, because he only did a few things, including these two movies. And this makes total sense for when I jumped in. They shot it with this as Darkman 2, and Darkman 2 is the third one.
Oh.
And at the last minute decided to swap them.
Switcheroo.
Because Larry Drake returns for the Darkman 2, which was intended as 3. So it makes more sense narratively that
Larry
this would
Drake
be...
Larry Drake returns. That's how you sell a video.
Exactly. It makes more sense that this would be the second one, and then the second one, the third. But anyway, I enjoyed it more than I remembered.
Do you like 3 more than 2?
Yeah, okay. I remember I didn't like 2 at all, but 3 was just so much fun, and I love Jeff Fahey, and he's chewing up the scenery. So Darkman 3, Die, Darkman, Die.
You're a braver man.
Wow, that's a big endorsement.
Yeah, that is.
Lucky you're out of the country right now.
Yes. I was cool with the first one. I did
the first
not
one's
make
great,
it past
and then,
that.
Yeah, once they cast Liam Neeson, I was out. Yeah. I mean, I was just like, what's a second-rate Darkman? And then
how did they knock out Bruce Campbell when he's at the end of the first one?
Yeah. He should have been.
That would have been so cool.
And it's like recasting. It's like recasting RoboCop for RoboCop 3.
That never worked. Or the TV show.
Hey, Becca.
What?
You know what I watched last night?
Did you get the fancy new Deep Rising Blu-ray? Because I did too.
Oh, snap.
It's so pretty.
Guys, let's talk about Deep Rising for a second.
Actually,
you know what? Leave the room. Becca and I are going to.
Because this is number 3 on my list
sweet
this
love.
Week.
About Deep Rising.
About Deep Rising. Deep Rising is really interesting because it was a film that I snuck into in Jersey City. When I was in film school.
Why were you in Jersey City?
Because it was where my apartment was in school. And at the time, I was like, oh my God, this is such a surprise. I remember it graced the cover of Fangoria. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, that looks really cool. The creature design looks cool. Rob Bottin's involved, da 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 da. And then I went in and I was like, wow, what a great surprise. And then I was like, wow, you know what's really cool is the 90s began with a great monster movie, Tremors. And it's wrapping up with a great monster
movie. Which is like literally Tremors. Look, I wrote down Tremors on a boat.
Tremors on a boat.
Yeah.
And so rewatching it now, many, many years later, and I honestly, I think I haven't seen it in like 10 years or so.
I watch it yearly.
I know. Yeah. But I wanted to see it in a pristine format, Becca. Mm-hmm.
I got it. So you were waiting.
For a cup of coffee.
You were waiting. Y'all just...
Continue. The funny thing is the movie still works. It's still... There's a lot of problems with it. Now I see it without the beer goggles and I go, okay, there's a lot of flaws with this, but it's a lot of fun because
it's so fun.
You've changed her. It's you.
It probably is, Elric, to be honest, but
it was never a flawless movie. Like, you know, there's The Shining and then there's Deep Rising.
Listen, Stephen Sommers wrote and directed the film. He is also the guy who went on to do The Mummy and The Mummy Returns mm-hmm. and Van Helsing. And, you know, this was just a dude like getting a giant monster movie into the studio system, Hollywood Pictures, you know, and kudos to him for doing that. Treat Williams is fantastic. And
you know what?
Oh, Famke, Jesus Christ. But I explained to Ciara because she was watching it and she couldn't stand it.
She couldn't.
No, I know. We'll talk about that later.
Oh.
But you got Kevin J. O'Connor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I said to her, I was like, you know what? Watch Treat Williams in this because who's the captain from Firefly?
Nathan Fillion.
This is Nathan Fillion before Nathan Fillion, which is very true.
It is.
He's got the swagger. He's got the
despondent personality. The
dry wit. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think Nathan Fillion owes a lot to John Finnegan, as played by Treat Williams.
We figured you out, Fillion.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, a lot of the laughs don't come as easy as they did, and probably because I think Kevin J. O'Connor is still
great. I was
going to
say, I will lose it at everything Kevin J. O'Connor says from Peanut.
His comic timing is great. But my God, does this movie get bogged down by awful VFX.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The visual effects in this film.
I do remember that.
I mean, I want to go in there and George Lucas the shit out of this movie and add in VFX that actually work, because then the movie would like get elevated so much more.
And I think that you're more aware of the visual effects because Rob Bottin's special effects on this are so amazing. Like literally when they pull the guy out of the monster's tentacle and he's in half, and then you see the monster and they're like on screen together, and you're just like, oh, that is the greatest corpse half person smiling at me I have ever seen next to a really bad looking monster.
Elric, do you know what this movie's about?
What, Deeper?
Have you ever watched?
Do you have a Deep Rising, bro?
I saw this in theaters.
You did?
Yeah. I remember really liking it, but I remember thinking the effects at the time were like, "Ah, that looks."
Well, yeah.
They still, yeah.
I watched everything back then, but I remember liking it. But I haven't thought about it until I met Becca, where every second week it's Deep Rising.
So. I know.
This is like, and we all have one. The movie that you throw on when you're about to go to bed. It's this and Fawlty Towers. I'm watching one of those two to fall asleep like almost every night. So, yeah, this is just kind of my go-to happy place.
I don't know if you noticed, but there are some really strange inconsistencies because you've got Treat Williams and Kevin J. O'Connor who are like over a workbench working on something. And then in the next room over, one of the bad guys, Kano from Mortal Kombat, gets eaten by a tentacle. And then he disappears, but then Treat Williams is like at the workbench and a gun falls. Kano's gun falls onto the workbench. And I was like, how'd the gun get from the next room over into this room?
Well, plus, I was always put off. Kevin J. O'Connor's girlfriend dies, and his response is just kind of like, meh. Then he moves on. It's literally in the first 15 minutes.
Because he does come into the room, and he's like, he says to Treat Williams, he's like, oh, by the way, the engine's not working, da-da-da-da. And then he's like, girlfriend? And Treat Williams is like, no. And then he's like, okay. And
then off he goes. It's really like a mad reaction. You're like, but you were just professing your love to her in the prior scene.
But it does have a lot of good surprises. Yeah. There's a lot of good reveals. Wes Studi is in this. So you get like, you know, wooden Wes Studi, you know, Wes Studi just giving his usual barking orders at people. And you're like, yeah, man, I miss Wes.
How close did this come out to Virus? Because I remember them being very similar, but this being Virus, much better. Because Virus is just
I think Virus
year.
Was. A
I remember
year
them
before?
Coming out very similar time, kind of like the way Leviathan came out.
Year after, yeah. There you go.
A lot of these films came out around the same time, but I think that's hardly a watchable.
But even though that the Deep Rising monsters and I got to say, Virus is I rewatched it last year or 2 years ago. It was whenever they came out with the new edition. And though I will not call it a good movie, it was amusing. Okay. I will say that
that's a good cast.
Jamie Lee will disagree with you, but okay.
It's not good. It's amusing. Yeah. But that said, I mean, I just love the fact that we do have a giant tentacle squid monster on screen. If it looks like shit, that sucks. I wish it looked better, but I'm still going to watch it because it's a giant tentacle squid monster.
And Jerry Goldsmith's score is fun. It's like the drums, the taiko drumming in it.
It's good.
Jerry Goldsmith, legend.
They
were a year apart, by the way. It was 98 and 99 for Virus.
Me and you were going to do both of them.
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't have this new one, but I bought it ages ago and I just never watched it. I have the original Blu-ray, which is a double feature of Deep Rising and The Puppet Masters.
Yeah. There's a trailer. And there's a trailer.
Oh, I've seen that movie. Right. That's not a good movie.
It's not good either, but it's double feature. It came together.
It's not good
this new
either,
blue.
I mean, it's not good.
I heard that. Did you hear that? I heard that. So this new blue, it's from Kino. It is absolutely beautiful. It is loaded with special features. And y'all should pick it up. That was my commercial for that.
Deep Rising.
All right.
I got a movie that's actually going to be, it's probably like number two of the year so far. It's up there with that Joaquin Phoenix, Lynn Ramsey movie. This film's called Beast. The secretary where I work saw it at a film festival a few months ago, and she told me it was her cousin's sister's mother. But she came up to me and she goes, you got to go see this movie. And I could never get to the theater, and she said it was the best movie of the year.
I've had a copy of this sitting on my desk for two weeks now.
I won it at trivia.
I was just kind of like, eh, I'll get to it. Like, the setup did not look that interesting.
This is how I saw it. I saw it because I wanted a trivia. I was so excited because I've been waiting to see it. I think it's on VOD maybe this week. Yeah, this is it.
Ben Strand, written or directed?
No, Michael Pierce.
Oh, okay. Then
I got
the wrong one.
Scroll down. You had the picture down below.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, there it is on the right. So basically, it's a romance in the foreground, and the background of the story is a horror film or a kind of serial death. So I guess first up, there was a real serial rapist slash murderer called the Beast of Jersey. And Jersey, I guess, is a small island town in the UK. And I guess, it, I mean, really scary stuff
that
when I looked
real,
it up.
That's real, right?
This like, part's
I remember
real, but
covering this on
it was
the
actually
website.
Really disturbing. I started because I wanted, because when I watched the movie, I was like, well, how much of this is like the actual story? And the real story, the guy's wearing like this weird mask and he was really terrorizing all the women in this town. And he was this normal married man with a kid and just really horrific stuff. This movie hasn't got any of that. What this movie is really about, it's about the, both performances in this are just utter like revelation. You're like, both these people are just fantastic. It's about a girl who's kind of lives in a very repressive family and she's trying to break out. It's a contemporary story. So the director of this, his name's Michael Pierce. I guess he grew up in this town and he grew up with the stories of these, of the serial rapist murderer. So the stories and the kind of way everyone felt in this town, felt terrorized at the time, is what he wanted to draw from. He didn't want to replicate that story. So he made a totally different story. And it's about this girl who doesn't really fit in with her family and everyone's like kind of the older sister who does everything perfectly. And she's just not fitting in. It's her birthday and she decides to go out dancing and she goes out dancing. And then as she's leaving, some guy gets a little forceful with her. It's like the next morning and he's kind of pushing her against the wall. And then suddenly like some shots are fired at the guy and he's like, what the fuck's going on? They're just obviously blanks or pellet guns or whatever. And it's this other character who chases him away and then just starts talking to her. And you know at this point that there's been multiple, and they're all redheads, including the main character, who have been murdered in this town. There's been, I think, 3 14- to 15-year-old girls who have been murdered. I don't think in this story it's rape and murder. So I think, you know, it's a little lessened in that kind of grotesque side of it. But you know that. So as soon as you see this girl with like vibrant red hair, you kind of know she's in danger of some kind. And her and this guy start to have this interesting romance. He's a total outsider. And the whole point of the story, it's one of those movies where it's like, it doesn't matter almost, is he the guy or is he not? What it is as soon as people believe you are, how that infects a relationship.
Yeah.
And it's a really romantic film. The way it's shot is gorgeous. It's like one of those really just beautifully made films. But it also kind of goes there at times and really plays. She has these really horrific dreams about, you know, just fears. But she's also not just an innocent, boring character. She has a really interesting backstory that when they get to, just it just makes the whole movie kind of come to life. But this wouldn't be a regular, like, it's the kind of movie where I wouldn't even know right now if I was making my horror list, my top 10, if it would be on that list or not, but it would be in my top 10 movies no matter what. So it's kind of fringe horror, but the world of this movie is, I would definitely encourage people who are into this stuff to check it out, because it's just really, yeah, it's kind of exciting, especially the performances of this movie. Yeah, I think it'll be a nice surprise, because I was kind of put off because the cover looks a little fairy tale-ish, and with the title Beast, my mind goes to, oh, it's a Beauty and the Beast play, and maybe that's in there just tiny bit just because of the word and the lore, but it's not that kind of story. It's a very mature kind of movie, but I think people dig it. I really liked it.
All right, so that's Beast by Michael Pierce.
Michael Pierce, yeah.
Cool. Nice. I got two quick ones. Following up on Dark Man 3, I was in a superhero mood. I checked out this obscure – well, it's not obscure, but Scream Factory put out this title a couple of months ago called Rendell Dark Vengeance.
I actually think that is obscure.
Yeah, well, I guess it is. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I've heard of this.
But it's a new release, so that's why it's not that obscure. It's obscure if it'd been out forever and we'd never heard of it. But no, this is from Scream Factory, and which is interesting because it's not really horror. Honestly, I watched it right after Dark Man 3, and it was kind of the perfect double bill because it's the first Finnish superhero, so it's a fully Finnish movie. Basically, it's kind of the traditional plot line of like The Crow and the original Dark Man, but with Finnish gangsters who are really quirky and funny. It's not funny like laugh out loud funny. It's just almost the way that this character keeps vexing the lead guy, who is the son of a really feared mob boss, and yet the son feels like he can't get anything right, and yet he's a total freaking psychopath and like kills guards and things like that, that when he gets pissed off, like goes through his tantrums and stuff. But the character just kind of looks, the Rendell character, just he kind of looks like, I don't know, like Batman sort of.
Deadpool,
or
Dark Deadpool.
Well, actually, if you're a comic book nerd like I am, there was a series that Marvel did called Squadron Supreme, which was basically the Marvel version of the Justice League. And so they have a Batman-like character called Nighthawk. I think that's his name. Yeah. So he looks exactly like Nighthawk. He's just all in black. He's got the armor and the mask. And
I saw the title, and I immediately thought it was Matt Wagner's Grendel.
Yeah. It does. Yeah.
Give me that Grendel movie.
Yeah. So.
Really, Ryan? Were you like that?
I have loved Grendel since middle school, and I've been yearning for some form of Grendel to come to the big screen, both in the Simon Bisley, like the big bulked out future one, but I also want the tuxedoed Grendel as well.
It's possible.
God, I mean,
they're adapting everything now.
I'm going to read this.
But yeah, so this isn't anything groundbreaking or new, but it's just, I don't know. I like traditional superhero stories, especially when they're not based on one that I've already known. And so it's kind of interesting to see a Finnish filmmaker try to do his own take on a really dark superhero. So if you're into that sort of thing, I recommend checking out Rendell.
Would you say it had a maudlin quality? Because I think of Finnish, it's always having a bit of a maudlin quality.
The maudlin.
Yeah, it's a bad British joke, though.
Sure, anyway. Sure. But more importantly...
Insider Finland joke, guys. Please tweet us if you got that joke, because I want to know what percentage actually get these references.
But more importantly, and maybe Ryan can help me out here, because I think you were still in the web world.
Oh, my
this
God.
Habit.
Not, oh, my God, this one.
Yes, no,
wait,
I was...
Hold on.
I want to see. Of course, the mighty Josh Miller, the programmer for Friday Night Frights came over, and we're like, let's watch a 3D movie of questionable taste. I had owned a movie called Priest in 3D.
Started in theaters in 3D.
Did you? Uh-huh. Here's the thing.
I remember that.
I know nothing about this movie other than Paul Bentley's in it, and then he also did simultaneously a movie called Legion.
Well, he did Legion with Scott Stewart first.
And then this.
And then Scott Stewart came back and did Priest. Both are Sony movies.
Yes, but they feel like the same movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I knew nothing about it, and so when I put it on and they start telling a story about priests fighting vampires, like, oh, there's vampires.
It's like Underworld.
They're just like, oh, cool. Yeah. All right, vampires. And also the other hilarious thing, I actually checked the time. It was a minute and 30 seconds in where basically you're thrust right into what these priests do, which is hunt vampires, and they're all recognizable faces, and one of them dies immediately. And Josh said, he's like, oh, well, it's a shame he's coming back as the villain. And I was like, hold on, just in case you're right. Oh, called it in 1 minute and 30 seconds. And he was correct. Yeah. One of these priests survives and becomes the villain of the story. But here's the thing. It is a lean, like, 80-something minutes. It's really short. And they really go for it. I knew nothing about the movie. Yeah. And like, they had this elaborate animated sequence that's explaining
how
these priests were put together.
Yeah. They got motorcycles.
So, like, they got motorcycles. They got gadgets.
Gadgets
that come out of, like, you know, because they probably spent a ton of money on it. It's so weird. And like, that's all we could keep commenting on is like, why would Sony make this?
What year is it?
2011.
So yeah, I mean, like, kudos to Scott Stewart and whomever wrote it. I mean, for like building a giant world and again, convincing a major studio to go, hey, so we get this world of priests and vampires and all this stuff, and it's not based on a comic book.
It is.
What?
Yeah, because I was like, this is too weird for a studio like Sony to just be like, sure. Oh. And so if you look at the writing credits, it is based on a graphic novel series called Priest. Mm. Because that was the thing. There's so many fantastical things about it and connections that you're like, this feels like a comic book for sure. And so it was.
Also, no one wants to go see a movie called Priest. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Words, now, here's the thing. It's not bad. It's not great. But it is thoroughly entertaining. And I enjoyed it for being probably the craziest studio movie to come out in 2011.
Yeah.
And the 3D's pretty good.
But all those movies have that same aesthetic palette, like Underworld and all. They all look the same. That blue, shiny, rainy, you know.
Oh, and actually the other thing was, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes in, Josh Joshua called it as, he's like, I think this is just a remake of The Searchers. And so we went on the IMDb and it said, the director says this is an homage to The Searchers.
Yeah. Like,
oh, an homage.
Always a classic go-to storyline.
Most certainly a retelling of that.
The sets were really impressive because when I was a journalist working for Shock Till You Drop, they had us down to the set. I mean, like, and it was right down here in Sony Studios. And they built out that giant cavern that they walk into where, you know, the priests are attacked. And I mean, it was giant.
So this did theatrical? practical in 3D? I literally remember nothing about this movie.
Big Sony release. I don't think it made any money, but it was a big thing. And he did a segment in Holidays. And,
oh, he did Dark Skies.
He did Dark Skies, which you and I like.
Oh, I like that movie. So
which
much.
Is a Blumhouse movie, right?
It's an alien film that feels like a haunted house movie.
Yeah, I like that one. So he's still done some stuff. But I just thought, like, I just want to know, because it's like he did a short film and his first two movies are Legion and Priest, these big budget Sony movies with Paul Bettany as the lead of both.
We want to know how you did
that. I want to know how that happened. Yeah.
Like, future guest. I'm calling it now. We're going to get him. Let's get him in here.
Okay.
I would just love to know how that just happened.
Yeah.
That's great.
So anyways.
I'll work on it.
Priest. Right. Priest 3D.
Well, I will do my graphic novel entries for the week because I'm back to teaching at USC, meaning I'm now spending an hour and a half on the subway a couple times a week, and so I've been binging my graphic novels again. So I will start with Nailbiter, which had
been Love that one.
Recommended. Yeah, I somebody one of our listeners recommended it to me at Texas Frightmare.
Yeah, and it was part of a pile. Like, a while ago, we got sent a bunch of graphic novels. And I don't know who got it. I read volume one and then passed it on to one of you.
I think I ended up with it because it's been on my desk for a while. Yeah. And then when I did Texas Frightmare, somebody was like, okay, you have to read this one. And I had Witches with a Y as well. So I read both back. I read Witches first. And then I finally got to Nailbiter this week. So this one, I only read the first volume, but I've ordered the next one. So this is an Image one. It is about a fictional town called Buckaroo, Oregon. And Buckaroo, Oregon is a very small town, but for some reason it has produced 16 of America's most violent serial killers. And so this guy, this kind of anthropologist research guy, decides to go to Buckaroo, Oregon to try to figure out what the secret is of the town. That what is it there that is causing all these people to turn out as serial killers? And they call them the Buckaroo Butchers, the 16 of them together. And he gets there and he calls up one of his partners that he works with a lot and says, I've discovered the secret. You have to get to Buckaroo now. And as soon as the guy rolls into Buckaroo, his partner has completely gone missing. And so he starts working with the local police to try to figure out where he may be. And they also, there's one suspected serial killer who was never convicted, who is the nail biter. And he becomes kind of their Hannibal Lecter, where they're using him as kind of intel. And the only thing that they know is shortly before he disappeared, this guy had been having lunches with the nail biter every day. And the nail biter's MO was that although he was never convicted for it, allegedly he chewed the nails and flesh off of the fingers of his victims before he killed them. And so, yeah, and it's super creepy. This one kind of stuck with me. And I usually don't read serial killer novels or graphic novels, and I think it's because of this reason where this one like haunted me. I was reading it on the subway, and then I'm like walking to class thinking about serial killers, and I kept thinking about the Iron Maiden song Killer, which is about literally a serial killer standing on the subway platform. And so yeah, this one kind of stuck with me, but it's real creepy. It's a real cool setup, and I'm really shocked this has not been picked for a movie yet.
You said it's Image?
Image.
Yeah.
It's not a movie, a show. I'm actually reading volume 2 right now.
It's really tight. I'm anxious to see where it goes, just because they have set up such a great world and mystery. And the art in it is real intense. And like, I have issues with nail biting anyway. And so to then like see it and they...
Wait, let's go back to that.
No, like I can't stand to watch people chew their nails. Oh, wow. It drives me nuts. And so, and they do these things where like they will literally have...
Just so people know, Ryan
stop
is...
doing it, dude!
I'm so tasty.
I can't handle it. Oh, that's like, it's a pet peeve. But then they'll have these pages where it's literally, you'll just see the guy chewing on his nails and you'll have the sound and it'll just say all the way across the double pages. And so it's really visceral.
My Image app, every time I pick it up, Hackslash.
It's worth it.
Yeah, it's cool. And the first one's like $8 on Amazon right now, volume 1.
Yeah, definitely worth it.
Have you read, have you checked out Beauty yet on Image?
I have not.
I think it's called Beauty. I started reading it on a plane last time I was flying, and basically the concept is the backdrop is a world in which there's an STD going around that makes you beautiful. And so you sleep with somebody, the next day you might be going about your day and you're completely fine, but by the time you wake up or wherever you are, you suddenly become absolutely gorgeous or handsome. And so dividing lines are drawn, like societal dividing lines are a little bit drawn, unspoken, you know, dividing lines. But it picks up at the very beginning where a woman who's absolutely gorgeous is on the subway, and then all of a sudden she just spontaneously combusts. And so what they discover is that people who have this STD are slowly spontaneous combusting. They don't know why. And it's a little bit of a procedural, which takes me out. We're following two cops. I kind of have a nitpicky thing about following cops. But it's about a female and male detective who are trying to get to the bottom of it. But the great thing is that we meet the male detective and he comes home and he sees his wife and he's like, oh, how was your day, honey? And she's like, oh, it's great. You know, everything's good. And then he sleeps with her. And then he wakes up the next morning and he's completely handsome and she's gorgeous. And he's like, oh, shit. And he discovers that his wife slept with somebody else who's got it.
Oh.
So they went through this transformation and he's just like, God damn it. And then the next thing you know, he's like moving out of the house. But he's now he walks in and his partner's like, whoa, hello there. And so it's a really interesting thing. I'm halfway through. I just got to a scene with a giant orgy and I was like, I'm going to save this for the I'm going to save this not for the plane.
I was going to read this elsewhere.
Yeah. But, check it out. It's cool world building stuff that puts a spin on, nice. You know, kind of body horror.
The other one that I'll talk about tonight literally came out like 2 weeks ago. And this was also recommended by a Shockwaves listener who actually emailed me this week and was like, this is fresh out. You have to get this. And once I started researching, it's called Bone Parish. And this is by the same guy who did Harrow County, which I'm still trying to get Ryan to read. So fucking read Harrow County.
Becca, you got to look at my reading.
Oh, my God. It took you like 9 years to read Hex. Nine years. But it's Cullen Bunn, the same guy who did Harrow County. This one is only in its very first issue. And according to headlines I saw while I was researching it, Boom sold out of it within the first like 2 days. And then people were buying copies on eBay for like $20. And this is just the single issue. And it's kind of worth it. And they now have like, I got it for like $4 on Amazon. So it's back down to like normal volume or issue price. But it's set in New Orleans. And the concept is that there is a new drug on the street and it is created by the ashes of dead people. And it's synthesized and it forms like this green kind of powdery drug and people snort it. And it has become the hottest drug on the street. And so it's these kind of warring factions of gangs trying to control it. But at the same time, when you use it, you get visions of the dead. And so these are like really horrific, like nightmarish visions of the dead. So then it becomes like, can you connect with the dead that way? Can you connect with past loved ones that way? And again, I'm only on the first issue, but it sets up a hell of a world. So I'm really excited to see where it goes. So that's Bone Parish. It literally just came out the last week of July.
Doesn't sound as good as doing Nuke. That's the good shit. Right into your neck.
Come to you, man.
Nuke.
Me and Beck have to give a shout out, plug to, and related to Ryan a bit. The Miskatonic Institute of Horror Studies is launching an LA chapter. There's already a London and a New York chapter. It will be in Los Angeles mid September.
Yes, we start September 13th.
Every second Thursday of the month for those 4 months in a row, there will be a deep dive horror lecture series. But the first one will be more of a conversation when thinking of who would be the best person to have a conversation with Don Coscarelli somehow.
Right? We went with Turek.
Who would that be?
So it's the Turek man. So you can come check out Turek doing like a long form lecture and discussion on Coscarelli.
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
But it also means I get to watch some of his other films I haven't seen in forever.
Yeah.
I got to refamiliarize myself with Beastmaster.
Oh, Beastmaster.
A few other things, yeah.
Yeah, so that should be a lot of fun. Keep an eye out for that. I think if you follow one of us on social media, you'll be able to find where this stuff exists.
Yes.
So I think it's a cool initiative what you guys are doing.
Yeah.
We also don't have long. So that, I mean, because LA, you know, it's kind of late. So we only have a couple weeks before the first one. Obviously, you want it to do well. It's in a really amazing location, very Lovecraftian library that a guy I work with kind of directed me to. And I was like, wow, it's called the School of Philosophical Research. And it's the guy, Philip Manley Hall, I guess he like married Bela Lugosi. Like he was the preacher who did Bela, but he was a philosopher. Just a really interesting kind of lore to the place. So I think the idea is to have these events. These were founded by Kayla Jennings, who's been on our show and is a great writer. She's been doing these all around the world, but it's to like do these deeper dives and keep, you know, horror, not just academic, because that sounds out of touch, but more like take it seriously, you know, and explore the lore. So it should be fun.
Yeah. And we'll let you know about some of the other lectures as they come closer.
Yeah.
All
right. And why don't you set up our guests? What is Crypt TV for those?
Well, we're bringing on the co-founder of Crypt TV, and Crypt TV is basically a YouTube channel and website that is basically spearheading something that not a lot of companies are doing right now, which is short form horror content.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing a lot of it. You're seeing a lot of stuff on Instagram. You're seeing a lot of stuff on YouTube, and you're seeing a lot of filmmakers create short films and put it out there into the world. Crypt TV is cultivating those filmmakers and basically building their own little universe of characters and filmmakers that they go to. It began when I initially met Jack many, many years ago, and he had created this app called Crypt TV.
I remember you showing me the app at Trivia Night, and we were
the app was interesting. It was like a little bit of Instagram. It was a little bit of social media. Eli Roth was a part of it, and over time, Jason Blum, my boss, became a part of it, and Jack had basically raised a lot of the funds himself to turn it from an app into a YouTube channel and a short film empire. So it's cool. It's cool to see. I see a lot of their characters out there. I see a lot of the short films being shared. And yeah, I thought it would be interesting to bring those two in, especially for you aspiring filmmakers out there who are looking for avenues to, tell stories and, maybe get your own characters out there into the world.
Cool. All right. Well, let's hear from our sponsors and we'll bring them on.
Sweet.
We live in fear of failure, commitment, each other and beyond. It's one of the few things that unites us all. Salem, Massachusetts knows this more than most, which is why Salem Horror Fest will return this October to explore societal themes of fear and anxiety in Halloween, capital of the world. Prepare yourself for 2 weeks of terror with screenings, panels, podcasts, special guests, parties, premieres, and more in the haunted and historic Witch City. Raise hell with Linnea Quigley and George C. Romero. Conjure demons with the Faculty of Horror and repent before the latest film from Darren Lynn Bousman. Behold Wolfman's Nards with the Monster Squad's Andre Gower and relive your kinder trauma for the New England premiere of the Scary Stories documentary. Yours truly, Ryan Turek, will present the opening night keynote speech on October 4th, followed by the 30th anniversary celebration of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark with Cassandra Peterson. Tickets and weekend passes are available now. To overcome fear, we must first understand it. SalemHorror.com.
From Severn Films, uncut on Blu-ray for the first time ever, The Horror of Party Beach. When nuclear waste dumped into the ocean mutates a shipwreck full of corpses, it will unleash an onslaught of bikini teens, buckets of gore, dubious science, and arguably the greatest worst monsters in horror movie history. I can confirm that. I saw it late night once, and it is a shocker. I think we called him the penis face monster or something. Anyway, that's off script. Severn Films is proud to present this cult favorite from Connecticut's own Ed Wood, now featuring a new 2K scan and loaded with all new special features like nothing that's ever stalked this earth. The Horror of Party Beach, the world's first horror monster musical. Visit Severn-Films.com for their full line of horror and cult classic special edition Blu-rays, including The Changeling, Fulci Zombie 3, Zombie 4, Shocking Dark, Eaten Alive, and Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals. Coming in September, I'm very excited about this, Joe D'Amato's Anthropophagus and Absurd. That is the correct way to say Anthropophagus.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they have all new Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 arrivals. Also the officially licensed Alien and Aliens collections featuring t-shirts and pins. The awesome new Warriors line is now available. The brand new They Live line featuring multiple shirts and awesome enamel pins. And they now have a full line of both House and House 2 merch available for both men and women, if you can believe that House 2 has merchandise now. So head to www.fright-rags.com now. You can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. Head over to www.fright-rags.com now.
The Blumhouse Podcast Network has recently launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes the players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week to hear what new horrific quest awaits. Currently available on the Blumhouse Podcast Network, and you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. And for more information, please find Fear Initiative on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
I just want to mention, too, that Slashback Video is returning to the Mystic Museum on September 8th. This is called Revenge of Slashback Video, and it is a sequel to that crazy installation that we did last year that thrusts you into the mom and pop video store experience. We'll have new tapes, we're going to have laser discs, we're going to have video games, we got new posters, we got new, all sorts of really cool new stuff. The reception, again, is September 8th, and the entire installation will be up until, I think, December. We're going to feel it out. It actually lasted a lot longer than we expected last year just because of the response. But head to facebook.com/slashback video or Instagram for more details. So
yeah. Last time there was a line around the block, so if we hadn't had our names on the list, I don't know if I could have ever made it into that.
I don't scare people.
We got to elbow ourselves in.
We'll get there early.
Yeah, get there early for sure. All right, welcome back. We've got two great guests in the house. I've known them for quite a long time, and it's probably going to be a busy period for them since Halloween is coming up, and I imagine you guys will have initiatives coming up. But welcome to the show, Jack Davis and Kate Krantz from Crypt TV. What's
Thanks,
up, you
guys.
Two?
How we doing?
Good.
Hello.
How are you?
Long time listener, first time guest.
Well, welcome.
Like that. Kate, I saw you at South by last. Jack, you come in every once in a while to grace our halls.
I move in the
wisdom.
Shadows.
Yeah, you bring your wisdom and creativity.
No creativity.
Plenty of creativity. But welcome to the show, guys. You guys, it's fun to see what you guys do. And I brought you on because you're kind of a facet of the horror industry that is recognizing new talent, giving new talent a platform upon which to do short films, but also creating IP. Is that a good description of what Crypt TV is all about?
I would say so. We look at ourselves as creating a new generation of IP, obviously geared towards a different audience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Crypt mainly distributes, almost entirely distributes online. We've done partnerships, but like our channels are online. And we have a huge YouTube audience, mm-hmm. which is mainly 13 to 24-year-olds.
Okay.
So we know that that audience, which is our core Crypt audience, has different viewing patterns around TV. Most of them will never get cable, not just cut the cord. And they don't go to movies as much. But we started the company because we love genre and we wanted to create some of the amazing things you are here creating at Blumhouse for film and TV, but for this audience, and it does, like you said very well, Ryan, lend itself to a younger filmmaker because we can take – our budgets are so low.
Right.
We can take risks on that 25-year-old, 26-year-old filmmaker who probably would in fact need more seasoning to do the 90-minute film or pilot.
Right. And I should preface this entire conversation for those aspiring filmmakers out there. I like that we do these episodes every once in a while where we bring someone on who can basically offer a little bit of film school,
mm-hmm.
Especially in the short film arena, because I think there's a lot – like David Sandberg was a good episode for that.
Yeah.
But Kate, why don't you explain exactly what you do over there?
Yeah. So I'm the chief content officer at Crypt TV, and we have an amazing team of people on the content team over there. We have people on the creative development, physical production, editorial – a lot of it's in-house, but we really prioritize reaching out to new voices who we either know inside of the community, we can bring into the community. We've brought directors on who aren't necessarily horror directors, but have fantastic visual stylistic choices that they're making in their work that we feel like we can work with them, put them through the Crypt boot camp, and put them in a position to succeed and communicate with the digital audience that, like Jack said, they're younger, they're excited about fresh IP and meaningful stories that connect to their real life inside of the genre space.
What are you guys known for? What characters have you guys created that have resonated?
Well, we've created over I think it's like 830 individual pieces of IP in the last 3.5 years.
Wow.
And of those, I'd say The Birch is a big hit. There's a lot of fandom there. Troubled Youth is a new one. Sunny Family Cult, The Looksee. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because a lot of our characters that we see pop off happen to be female, or at least more feminine in their design if they're monsters.
Yeah.
That's not the rule across the board, but it is a trend that we've noticed. But, you know, like Troubled Youth has a little bit more levity in tone, and it feels fun and poppy. And then something like The Looksee is this creature, more classic horror. So it runs the gamut in terms of what kind of IP people are excited about.
Now, what type of parameters do you put on the filmmakers? Because I know a lot of times if I'm on Facebook or YouTube and I click on a horror short and it loads at 17 minutes, I'm like, oh, God, I don't have time for this. But I love the crypt ones because they're always like 3 minutes. So do you tell people to like keep the time down or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we have over time, we've really evolved our parameters. When we first started and Jack and I were sitting in the closet in the kitchen of Blumhouse, we were doing like 15-second, 1 minute long scares. But over time, we've realized we see a full vision of the crypt multiverse. All of these characters we're creating do intersect. So we do a lot of ideating internally in terms of the parameters for the character and how they plug into the universe, because we hold the key to that. And our job is really to show creators the goalpost and let them do what they do best. So right now we're greenlighting 3 buys for our series. That's anywhere between usually 5 to 7 minutes an episode, but we're not 100% locked on that runtime. It's more about what do we need to do to establish a really powerful story and connect with our viewers. Sometimes it's a little more, a little less, but we're flexible on that front.
And one thing that we've seen that's very interesting to your point, Rebecca, once to bring in new viewers, you need it to be those 4 to 5 minute episodes. And we see a lot of the new fans that are coming into Crypt are coming in that exact way. They see the Looksee, they see that episode one has 5 million views, they watch episode one. But what we're seeing, the longtime Crypt fans and the young fans are starting to watch now 20-minute long episodes of our best stuff.
Oh, that's terrific. Mm-hmm.
So we've seen that people are watching longer and longer content, but that's once they become really established fans. Like the 13 to 24-year-old, I think the biggest misconception about them is that they won't watch long-form content. They will. You just have to slowly build their brand affinity and trust. And now our 18-minute supercut of The Looksee Season 1. So each episode was like 4 or 5 minutes. The 18-minute supercut has 4.7 million views on an 18-minute video. Mm. And 60% of those views are 13 to 24-year-olds. So they will never, like you said, they don't usually start by watching the long form. But once you build their affinity for a character, they will sit there and binge. Mm-hmm. And we actually see that when a new fan is converting into a loyal fan, they spend a whole day just watching our library of stuff. But they don't usually come in unless it's that short form, like you said.
And do you guys push like the cover photo? Because like throughout my duration at like Fangoria and Blumhouse, I remember anytime we made a short, kind of one of the only things I was concerned about at the end of the day was could I pull an interesting still from it? Because that's what was going to lead to clicks. It didn't matter how awesome or bad the short was. If I couldn't pull a good still, it meant nothing. So do you guys push those as well?
I mean, that's definitely part of our process. It's a symbiotic relationship for everything at Crypt between distro and content. It all starts with a fantastic idea for a character and making that connect, but it all flows together. I mean, having those really powerful hyper-visual grab you stills that actually feed into the story without just being clickbaity on the surface is critical for us, and making sure that those thumbnails and the branding for each individual piece of IP is thoughtfully built out is critical. Yeah.
So how do you guys find new talent? Because, I mean, I know, like, Chelsea started there, and she's now directing features, and there's a number of, I think Dick Grunert did stuff for you, and there's a number of people who are now kind of rising up in the ranks of horror Hollywood that started with you guys. So how do you find new talent?
It's so exciting because, like, every time we see these success stories, like Chelsea getting to Chelsea Stardust, amazing director, worked at Blumhouse before this, and now is off directing, and it's just, it's amazing because it is a community of people, and what we love to do is support these voices. And, you know, no matter what she does in her career, she has these amazing shorts on Crypt TV that she can always point to, and what a cool stamp.
But Graham Denham did some, right?
Yeah,
Graham's a feature awesome. Coming up, and yeah.
You know, I wish I had like a secret answer for you of like how we find this pool, but it really is just having an impeccable team internally, and we're always combing for new people. We're looking on YouTube, we're taking meetings. All of our directors, for the most part, in-house on content, they're non-union. So we're not going the traditional agency route and like going wide. A lot of it is word of mouth, but we watch everything out there. When people submit content to us, we're watching everything that they send and making sure that we're flagging who we see potential with, maybe for a project now or down the line. But more than that, when our fans are saying, hey, look at this person, that means more to us than anything, and we always take that into account.
How do people, I guess the opposite is, how do they find you? Like, obviously, when you guys were first starting, you'd probably be a lot more open to the open submission and people pitching ideas. Mm-hmm. Where does that lie now? Is there a clear process if somebody's a young filmmaker out there just wondering how to even get to you guys?
Yeah, we have an email, submissions@cryptv.com. A lot of people come through there. People can submit us their shorts. People can submit us their scripts. I would let you speak on this, but I feel like a lot of the way we meet new people is actually like referrals, which seems kind of weird for filmmakers. But if we find someone who thrives in our process, more often than not, their friends or their community, their circle, are other young, scrappy filmmakers, and say, hey, I think this person would succeed really well in the Crypt format.
Yeah, and I think early on too, I think I met Graham through Chelsea as well, but you know, everyone brings their friends together, and our whole mentality is like, family works best with family. These are quick, fast shoots. We want it to be a positive experience. We're never going to force somebody that we like just because on you in terms of your key hires. We'll always be there to suggest. But that community aspect, I think, is really important. And, you know, we're not buying scripts cold right now because we have a vision for the characters that we need to plug into the universe and populate these crossovers in a meaningful way. But we are looking at material and kind of flagging who has a really fantastic voice, who's good at world building and characters and scares. And we do bring them in-house and they, you know, help collaborate with us on those projects.
What's the one thing that's taken off that you guys didn't expect? Was there a particular short?
I would say maybe this short, which we're probably going to grow into a series, because now Crypt, it started as just shorts, and now we turn our best stuff into series, and those really work. I would say, I'm curious for your answer, Kate, but I would say My First Day, this very fun short that's sort of about a kid going to serial killer school. Hogwarts for serial killers, if you would. It was great, and we really liked it, but I think that's where it's a relationship between data and content. Because we get so much data, we feel like we know what's going to work. And then I'm sure you've seen this in your career. Like, something that you think is going to be a hit surprises you and doesn't perform as well, and you're like, well, I can't see the future. And then My First Day is an example of where I watched it, I liked it, I'm like, this is cool. And it has, I think, 40 million views between Facebook and YouTube.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's just been amazing to see. And we would love to do more with it because it's success. And again, I always liked it, but that's what's fun about this kind of internet world, which is you feel like you can predict so much, but you're always surprised in both directions eventually.
Yeah. I think definitely My First Day. I think, honestly, we made The Birch when it was me, Jack, and Darren. Like, that was at the beginning.
Oh,
and
my gosh. That one is so expensive looking. And
thank you.
Elegant. And thank just, you. I mean, like, it. I didn't realize that you guys had, like, made that and funded it from the start. I assume that, honestly, because usually when I see international projects, I go, oh, they have that, like, international film lottery money. I assume that was, like, a $20,000 short that they'd made in Britain.
No, I mean, you know, we always believed in, the filmmakers are fantastic. Mm-hmm. They're from Bloody Cuts in the UK, Ben and Anthony. But when it came in, I didn't know how people would receive it because it's super emotional. It's about bullying. It's scary because you're seeing a kid like get punched in the face in the woods with another kid holding a knife. Like,
and
that's
dead
the scares. Yeah, like the whole thing. It's a very emotional, serious, heart-wrenching story. And we only see the character in that for what? 2 seconds in full form.
Yep.
So I wasn't sure how people would take to it, but I think that's the power of the genre space. And I mean, like, our fans, people are smart, man. These kids are smart. You don't have to over explain things. If it's authentic and rooted in something that no matter who you are, where you're from, you can relate to. Everyone in this room, I guarantee, we all have stories about bullying, watching a friend, being bullied ourselves, being a bully, whatever it is. It's so relatable. And ultimately, the message beneath it is positive, even though it's pretty gory and brutal, right? But people really took to it. We have fans all over the world who one woman sent us a picture. She had the birch tattooed on her back, like what? A full back
it's
piece.
It's such a beautiful monster.
We have like 30 to 40 people yeah. have gotten birch full
and,
tattoos.
And I think that was the most surprising to me. Yeah. Like to see a character that's a scary character connect with people in that way, that they identify with it and want to carry it with them, is very powerful.
Interesting.
One of my favorites that you guys did, and I'm going to say this wrong, the Mordow.
Oh, Mordeo.
Mordeo. Yeah. It was the kind of updated version of the Wendigo mm-hmm. mythos. I loved that one.
I'm happy.
I wanted it to be a movie.
You will be seeing more of that
okay,
shortly.
Okay, good, because I really liked that one.
Yeah, that was another fan favorite that we're going to definitely be growing. And, you know, that's something, too, where we, early on, were populating all of these characters crossover. And you can see in the comments, people pick up on the birch symbols actually hanging in the background with Mordeo. Mm. And they're excited about that, and they're demanding more crossover and universe. So that's our focus. We do as the fans ask.
And who oversees like the crossovers? I mean, like in the Marvel universe, you've got Kevin Feige kind of pulling the strings, and then you've got, you know, there's showrunners mm-hmm. on a TV show. Who is behind all of that?
Myself, yes. And then my amazing development team, Dane and Jasmine. When they're developing with new filmmakers, you know, the expectation isn't that a writer comes in and magically has all the knowledge of this mega document that says what is to come yeah. in the universe, but they're really good at providing the information of kind of the baseline. This is what we're going to have incorporated in this. This is what it's teeing up for. And I think it's an empowering experience ultimately for these filmmakers to know, like, you are creating this mega character in our universe, and it's so important, and you get to curate the style for that and how we execute it and right. make a really impactful first step. But I see that with my development team for the most part.
Kate's being humble, but she's been working on our universe document for 2 years. And it's actually, you mentioned, Ryan, it's October and we have exciting things coming.
Yeah.
We have distilled it down to a consumer version mm-hmm. now, because the full document is, you know, 50 pages and very, very, very long and intensive. But we've been working on it so long, we almost have the 4-page, like, if it were to ever get leaked, right? Like, here's like a consumer way to understand it. Like, this mm-hmm. is what the consumer is going to see. Because the 50 pages consumers could see, but that's all the rules, every period in time. I'm not as creative as anyone in this room, but when I saw the full 50-page universe document for the first time, I'm like, wow, you're really covering every 200-year period of ever and what happened. Like, that's pretty intense. That's not going to always be seen on the screen right away, but we have an incredibly detailed plan, and Kate is not giving herself enough credit for working on it for years now.
Now, I don't take offense by this question. Mm-hmm. I don't mean it to sound pointed, but I'm generally intrigued on like what your business model is mm-hmm. because shorts don't make money. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, you could get 400 million views on Facebook and it's not going to make any more than if you
question.
Got two. So how do you guys turn a profit?
So I will answer that question and maybe speak to something even bigger, which we've all seen here in this industry. You cannot build a sustainable business on just YouTube and Facebook alone. They do not give you the tools. Should they give you those tools? Are they actually right not to? Is it their responsibility? This is obviously a question where publishers are going to be biased one way and maybe the platforms are biased a reverse way. But the simple fact is, what we get paid for a million views on a 20-minute video, right, that's the Looksy Supercut, is not even a fraction of what a million views of a TV episode yeah. is. It's not even close.
Like, you're literally getting pennies. Like, the CPM is so low mm-hmm. on that.
And
so
it's
really
not just the CPM
works.
Is so low. What I find so interesting about our and you guys are experts, so I love the discussion. A cat video, no disrespect to cat. I have a family cat. We love cats.
I love
but
cat
a cat
videos.
Video, you know, like a cat, like, you know, flushing the toilet, right? Those views have the same CPM as a very beautiful produced drama short or comedy short or sci-fi short. What will make the internet difficult for professional creators to monetize is that the CPMs are the same no matter who you are. That's part of the genius of unlimited supply, but part of the difficulty when you're not just making the content for literally free. So how Crypt makes money is we actually have to evangelize, and it actually, I think, helps us stay focused on our goals. We have to evangelize our fans so hard that we make money direct to consumer, basically taking their fandom on YouTube and Facebook and monetizing it off the platform directly, or working with branded advertisers, which we do. We work on every movie studio campaign and TV, so we'll go make custom content. You know, today we aired custom trailers we created for The Nun. And we can sell those at our own CPMs then, because then we're not selling them right through Facebook and YouTube. We're going to the studio and selling those packages because they want to activate our audience. So whatever our YouTube, Facebook CPM is here, but we can go sell even our YouTube and Facebook audience to those studios up here because we're creating the content and they need to drive those people out. And then we also create long-form programming. So we've done partnerships with Go90 and Fullscreen, who we love, but obviously those are defunct now, but we're very excited that in the coming weeks we're going to announce long-form shows with platforms that are not defunct, that are big platforms and streaming platforms. So I would say our business breaks down into three parts, right? One, growing the characters we've created into more traditional long-form partnerships. We've done some, but we're down to about to announce a big slew I'm very excited about. Two, branded advertising that's really on target with TV networks. Like, you know, we do American Horror Story and we do The Nun and, you know, we've done every scary movie that's come out the last 2.5 years. And then three, which is, I would say, the most important part of our business that's really growing the most, direct-to-consumer, mm-hmm. selling merch. We're having a live event here in L.A. that we sold out of in 4 hours today to do a premiere for Look-See Season 2 and Sunny Family Cult Season 3. We've also licensed our characters to open theme parks. Last year, we had Giggles the Clown as the opening weekend attraction at Not Scary Farm, and we'll be doing a lot more partnerships like that. So those are the three buckets it breaks down. I would love the business to become as much of that third bucket as possible, the direct to consumer. Because A, that's the only way you can truly own your fan when you don't need someone else to say yes to something. You have the relationship with them. And I actually think if you focus on direct to consumer, that's how you build the best content. Because Kate has a very difficult job, and unfortunately she has to go do all these crazy, difficult, different tasks because the mission can change and if you are a direct-to-consumer business, if I can just say to Kate, hey, the best way we make money is you make content our fans truly love and don't have to worry about how we, you know, pitch something or sell something or frame it, that's the most sustainable way to grow Crypt. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're seeing the most exciting budding growth in over the last few months. And when I look at the next 2 years, that's where my focus really is.
I was going to say, what is the ultimate end goal? Having one of these characters on a 40-foot screen, or do you think that they just work solely for that demo that you're talking about on a mobile app, on a computer? I mean, like, do these characters and these IP have longevity outside and in theaters, or is that you're just isolating your audience at that point?
The ultimate goal is to create great IP and great monster stories that people can pass from generation to generation, like the best scary characters of all time.
Right.
You know, we're about to see this amazing Halloween movie that I can't wait for. And, you know, I'm going to be in Toronto. I'm not saying I have to get tickets from any of you guys here, but I'll be there.
Subtle.
The reason that's going to work, other than the new movie looks great, is it's a story that one generation saw and is interested in experiencing again, and obviously now passing down to a new generation who wasn't alive when it was first seen.
Right.
That's the goal of Crypt. Create characters that 13 to 24-year-olds who are watching now love, that they want to experience again and again as they get older, and eventually they pass it down. Does that mean it's a movie? Does that mean it's a digital series, or we have to monetize all through merch? I think it can be all the above, but I would say it only works if the content's great. And when we look to companies for inspiration, do we look at a company like this company, Blumhouse? Of course we look at Blumhouse for inspiration, creating some of the best stories that are going to truly transcend decades and culture. But in the nature of the internet business, we also look at a Rooster Teeth, if anyone's familiar with Rooster Teeth, or Barstool Sports, which is two digital brands that created such amazing communities who cared about them so much that both those companies, Barstool and Rooster Teeth, throw their own conventions and get 40,000 people to come. That is something we want to build towards in Crypt. So as long as we can do that, and that's going to only come from our characters, I'll be happy.
Yeah. Now, what is the event that you guys sold out on?
We are having a little premiere in Los Feliz for the Look-See Season 2 and Sunny Family Cult Season 3. We actually debuted Look-See Season 2 in a partnership with Rooster Teeth at RTX Convention in Austin. Those are some of our probably two of our four biggest IP, Sunny Family Cult and Look-See. The new seasons are coming out August 31st for Look-See and September 4th for Sunny Family. But we want to give people a full binge sneak peek. And we're going to release them weekly, but we're going to screen them all at once the whole seasons and do a little Q&A with our lovely filmmakers who directed those seasons.
Wow. I'm curious about the running times of the most successful content, because obviously you talked about supercuts can still be hugely popular even at 90 minutes. But is there a formula, like a 3-minute mark, a minute and a half? Has there? I mean, I know that trying to create viral thing is an impossible task in the first place. But is have you seen patterns to this that might even help somebody make their first little film?
Yeah. I mean, I think we definitely look to distro and data to help us understand how to optimize for the platform we're creating for. That was kind of the first step in a lot of this content. And we only recently in the past year launched our YouTube, so it was singular. Now that we have our YouTube, though, we have the breath to really explore characters and arc them out and live in the moment, which is so critical for this genre to get a great scare, great reaction. I don't think it's just limited to, you know, do 3 minutes and you're good to go. I think that active storytelling and making sure that the pacing feels...
I think getting someone's attention in the beginning.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Rebecca hit this, I think, so well at the beginning of our conversation of people were initially brought into Crypt with the 4-minute video. The hardcore fans that now are loyal to us will stay and watch anything, but that wasn't obviously the case when you got them. So what I would say to the startup filmmaker is... Because we're assuming here, if you're an independent filmmaker, you're trying to self-distribute this or get someone to pick it up and cover it. You don't have the built-in distribution on the internet. The first 15 seconds are so important.
Super hyper-visual.
Super hyper-visual. The thumbnail, an action, something that makes you say, hey, I'm not going to just scroll through whatever else I'm scrolling through. Crypt now, and I think it makes our content better, has the luxury that hopefully you feel like, go make great stuff, and we have enough real loyal fans that they will watch. They know our best IP. That was not the case until maybe the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, it was we've been around for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So before that, it was a 2.5-year slog of building the fans, and you have to do those tricks. So if you're starting fresh as an independent filmmaker, you do need to pay a lot of attention to those first 15
seconds.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of habits we have to break almost from people who are coming from the traditional world or right out of film school, just because, you know, you can't be an indulgent filmmaker if you're talking to this audience on these platforms. You really have to respect it from their perspective. And there's a lot of beautiful shots, there's a lot of beautiful moments, but ultimately what's necessary to establish a world, establish a character, and get them into the next episode, or like Jack said, get them from this first taste into a supercut, that's the priority. It's their viewing experience. That's it.
Yeah.
Have you considered bringing in like guest filmmakers to try what you guys are talking about and doing something in a super short form? You know, I mean, obviously Eli Roth was part. Eli is still part of this, right?
Eli is my co-founder in Crypt.
Right, right.
And the first ever people were Eli and Jason Blum. Yeah. So I got really lucky. Good two folks to have in at first. But I think we'd work with any filmmaker who's truly excited about our process.
Yeah.
I think that even though some Crypt characters have grown into traditional, and those are, you know, the nature of some things we're about to announce, and we've done long form series. If you want to come work with Crypt, you can't be thinking this is a means to an end. And it's like what you said about the format. Unless you truly embrace, I'm here to create a great story for the Crypt fans on the YouTube platform and everything that means, it's not going to work. So I think anyone who's truly excited to play in Crypt's playground and what's endemic to that, we would work with in 5 seconds.
Yep.
I almost feel like Darren Bousman or Marcus Dunstan have like that kind of like... I like the headspace for telling something in a very condensed, really quick time. I was just thinking about it because there are those filmmakers that have the aesthetic that where they want lingering shots. They want, slow pace. And I'm just like, who is
especially in the feature world where it's exposition.
There's a time and a place, for sure. Yeah. It's just a little, it's counterintuitive to how our consumer is going through our content.
It's being loyal. You have to be excited about the format you're creating in. And I think the filmmakers that we've seen thrive, it's kind of a perfect marriage in the sense we're going after young filmmakers to help give them a voice, to break through filmmakers who would need to probably wait a few years and get a few more notches on their resume to get the TV pilot or the film. But they also then, you know, paradoxically perhaps, are perfect for Crypt because they're 25, 26. That's why they can't reach the film TV level yet. But they consume a lot of YouTube content because they're that age range girl band. So they understand the pacing and how to be endemic to the format. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of weird how it works. But again, once you are watching a movie, you've bought your ticket. You're sitting in the theater. Even if the first 10 minutes aren't your favorite, you're going to forget that if you love the 90-minute experience.
Yeah.
When you're on YouTube and you can just click out at any moment in time, you have your entire internet there to give you attention, you do have to make the format more conducive to people wanting to sit all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Jack, there was a time
when you and I sat at the Oaks Gourmet and you had an app. It was the Crypt app. When did – at what point – I lost track after because I started here. But at what point did it make the leap from app to what it is now? What happened between then and there?
I'm very impressed you remember the Oaks Gourmet because I did not – I knew that we were buddies and would sit down.
I had a breakfast burrito. It was delicious. There was an annoying person next to me, but go on.
Do you remember every day?
Was I the annoying
people?
Fuck no.
Well, I want to make sure that I wasn't the annoying person next to me.
No.
We were sitting across from each other.
We had
right?
some Snoopy snoopersons next to us that wanted to get in on our conversation.
Well, and that was Kate, them. And that's how we met.
That was Kate.
That's how I started at Crypt, guys.
Kate, yeah. You know what? You de-aged because you were.
I know.
You look like an old lady.
I got secrets, guys.
To answer your question, it was, I think, seeing the demand for what the young consumer wants, which is it's very hard to bring people to your own playground, so to speak, on the internet, right? Everyone knows it's most valuable if you can get someone to go on your site or download your app. But I think when that transition happened, Ryan, is me as a, you know, young buck realizing, hey, what's the core what can this company be? The core competency is creating great content, right? Owning distribution, if you get it right, is massive and a huge deal. But it's very, very hard. YouTube is an incredibly well-built video player. Why? Because there's 10,000 engineers there who their only job is to make that experience seamless and recommend your other content. So I would say the transition happened when what is the best version of this company? A great content creator creating new IP for a young audience. Oh, what's the best way to get people to watch that en masse so the thing can actually succeed? By being focused on we create stuff and put it on YouTube and Facebook's pipes, and we're going to focus on the stuff, not on the pipes.
Yeah. Who, out of the, you know, we talk a lot about the IP, we talk a lot about the characters, we talk a lot about the demo, but the filmmakers, you mentioned the Birch. Who are other filmmakers that you guys are really excited about right now?
Oh, man. I think Landon Stammer is amazing. I think he's really unique, too, in that he's a Swiss Army knife. So he writes, he directs, he produces, he does his own sound, post, like all the VFX. The kid can do it all. And I think working with a creative that understands and respects all pieces of the process and what it takes to make a fantastic product and is a real team player in the atmosphere, whichever role he's in, huge deal, huge win.
I'll add that Landon's the creator and director of the Look-See, mm-hmm. and he did season one, and he did all of season two.
Yeah.
August 31st.
I think John Ross is another fantastic director that we have. He's worked on a few pieces for us, like Thing in the Apartment, more classic horror. He's just fantastic with God, he scares the shit out of me. I mean, even now, watching The Thing in the Apartment, the original one, I have a moment where I have to, like, block my eyes every single time because he just really gets you. I think we talked about Ben and Anthony. We have this short, Troubled Youth that we worked with two sisters on the first one to write and direct, the Dell sisters, that were fantastic. And then we just completed a new fresh season of that. And that's a good example of something where, you know, it evolved over time where we were able to plug in our vision for the universe for the rest of the episodes in-house for that season to really execute. I think Chloe Acuno is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Slut.
Is,
I love Slut. That's really
I
fun.
Love Slut. It's
has she, so
awesome.
She, I don't know if she had done, has she done stuff for you guys?
We actually aired Slut on Crypt, so that's when we first met. But, you know, it's somebody that we always have been in conversation with and is just so smart and fantastic and beautiful filmmaker. Yeah, I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds, and I'm so proud of all of them. I really don't look at anything that we've done as, like, an embarrassment or a failure because we've learned and we've connected with an audience and there's fandom around all of it to varying degrees. So they're all amazing.
Did you have something there?
I was going to say, how did Slut perform on the network? Because it's a little bit different than a lot of the stuff I see in that it's a little bit headier. It doesn't have a big gore sequence or a monster. It's a little bit more internalized.
It actually performed very well. Yeah. And I think that speaks to Chloe's talent. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to the weird blend you have to find on the internet, right? If you are just trying to go for the lowest brow, it can work for a while, but it'll eventually eat itself. You have to find that balance between something that, again, is endemic to the format, but great stuff will always shine through. And I think Slut's actually something that didn't take off right away when we posted it, but had a continual slow build. And sometimes those are the best performers that they don't get 90% of their traffic in the first 48 hours. You actually see the trend line of just always there and then a bump 2 months after, and that's what Slut was. And that's what we've actually seen, ironically, on The Birch, which is The Birch is now at, I think, over 50 million views, but it's been pretty consistent in its distribution.
What's the one we loved with Carrie Coon, that last year's short?
Great Choice.
Great Choice would make a lot of sense on there because it's not such a viral. Have you guys seen it yet? It's
Send it our way.
Robin
it's
Commissar.
A guy stuck in a Red Lobster commercial.
Carrie Coon, the actress, ends up in this 80s Red Lobster, and it keeps going, and it gets so intense
it's actually
kind of terrifying. Yeah. But just one of those great, crazy shorts that feels like something that would be best discovered through the internet, like rather than a film festival, like almost thinking what you're watching is a mistake, but then it becomes this amazing little piece. But yeah, it would be worth looking that one up.
An itch to watch that again.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to get some Red Lobster.
Yeah. Is that one back on? Is it online?
I think it's just finished its festival. Okay. Probably.
Now, do you have? Because you just reminded me of things that we loved at festivals, and I immediately thought about Gwilliam. Do you have like any type of kind of regulations of this is too extreme? We can't put this up, or you know, do you stay PG-13 or PG-13 plus blood? Mm. You know, how do you kind of gauge what works?
I mean, we don't have like an internal rating system, and because we're controlling and ideating it in house. I mean, anything that's like super excessive torture porn is not really our vibe. Period. Mm-hmm. The mission on the content side is to create culture changing monsters that bring the world closer together. So inherently, that has a lot of positive undertones, and we anchor everything in the emotional truths that our fans can relate to. So I don't think that's something we've really struggled with yet. I think we're already thinking more character focused than how bloody can we go.
Yeah.
That being said, we've decapitated a lot of people in our time. So clearly that's like the fun of it and seeing bits and pieces. But the tension building scares, I think, are a lot more satisfying for our viewers than anything else, especially when they're done right.
Nice. Mm. You mentioned Rooster Teeth earlier and them doing some activations, outside activations. Mm-hmm. What is there a future for that for you guys as well? I mean, you mentioned
the entire future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned Giggles being part of, what was it, Knots?
She's at Knots.
So, I mean, like, you know, is there a future for like other haunts based on your IP and other stuff like that?
Everything Crypt has done with everything we've done in every sector of direct to consumer, right? Which isn't always us being direct, right? But merchandise, live events. Mm. Is there anything that fits in that bubble besides merchandise and live events? I think those two are pretty
games,
broad.
But video games.
Yeah. We've done almost everything with a partner before, right? We were partners with Spencer's last year, distributing merchandise in over 200 Spencer's stores.
Oh, wow. Spencer's.
And we loved working with them, as I'm about to now why we're not working with them, because we've been able to bring our merch completely in-house now.
I see that, yeah, on your site.
We've been able to bring our merch completely in-house. Merch is a huge growing business for us.
Right.
So everything we do, we would love to do direct and completely control the process. And Spencer's was a great partner. I just, you know, probably shouldn't have said that, but it's a pretty good example. It's a pretty good example of that helped us understand stuff about merch, but the dream is always to go direct to the Crypt consumer. You know, we went to RTX, me, Kate, Darren, our chief operating officer, and Alex and Alyssa and Brendan from our distribution team. And Rooster Teeth Convention, if you haven't been, it's just amazing. It's just, you can't believe it. First off, it's awesome. Secondly, there's 30,000 people who are there, and they're there for Rooster Teeth content, but there's also then they bring in local vendors in Austin to kind of put displays up. Mm. And it's just, you actually feel at home there. You feel like this is an event that knows what it wants to be. And mm-hmm. I'm sure we've all been to conventions that feel like forced or they don't have an identity, and we've been to conventions that they know what the atmosphere is supposed to be here. And the reason why Crypt wants to have our own haunt one day or have our own live event around our monsters or why we do our own premiere or why we want to have merch all be through our site and our store is because that's the only time you can keep it organic and true, when you are the one bringing the message to the consumer. And it's why I feel like we'll actually make better content the more we can grow our direct-to-consumer business. Because if I can give the message to Kate of your only, you know, way your job performance is judged is how much our consumers like our content and nothing else, and we're getting them to spend their money in various ways, it'll actually lead to the content getting better. So our entire future has to be direct-to-consumer. If 2 years from now we're not doing 10 times more direct-to-consumer stuff, and live events and haunts, we're probably in trouble. So I certainly hope so.
I'm sure you'll get there. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You know, I think, just again, going back to that breakfast meeting that we had and seeing where you guys have gone, it's definitely an inspiration, and I think it's a good hub for, you know, filmmakers. So
yeah.
Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for hosting us.
Thanks, guys.
Of course.